Well, let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, You are heavenly. You are the one who created all things, the one who created the order, each thing after its own kind, and created man, male and female, in Your image. In the midst of our ever-changing world that we see with our eyes and other physical senses, we know that this structure and order that You created exists. You designed it, You gave everything purpose, and therefore everything ought to behave a certain way. That ethics is tied to this structure and order. And since we are social beings, meant to have a relationship with You and also one another as human beings, the ordered structure applies to civil government. I pray, dear Lord, that You would give us understanding as we study Aristotle and think about how he understood the world. And we know, dear Lord, that he was a pagan, but because of Your common grace, restraining sin, total depravity is not utter depravity. There is much that we can learn from Aristotle, as Aquinas evidenced. Teach us, we pray. Rebuild our ruins and restore our race for Your glory and our good. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Today we look at Aristotle, and just as a quick refresher, you remember that after the 27-year Peloponnesian War, at the end of the 5th century, the end of the 400s, from 431 to 404 BC, that 27-year war between the League of Sparta and the League of Athens, everybody pretty much decimated themselves. You remember that the Sophists pretty much dominated culture at that time, their way of thinking. Many individuals were Sophists. You can think of Protagoras as one of the leading Sophists. Protagoras is the one who said, man the measure, and that everyone's perception, every individual's perception of reality is true for himself. So to him and the other Sophists, everything was relative. What is true for one person is true for him, and what's true for another person is true for that person, even if they oppose one another or contradict one another. Everything was subjective and relative. So for the Sophists, remember, universal words like justice, goodness, truth, beauty were all relative. They didn't really represent reality, real things, these universal words that are very important when you think of justice, goodness, truth, and beauty. You remember Socrates once said that beauty remains after the rose fades. What Socrates, who died in 399 BC, and his student Plato, who died in 347 BC, and his student Aristotle, who died in 322 BC, all argued that there is objective truth, objective reality, that universal words such as justice, goodness, truth, and beauty represent real reality, and that everything has a being, a form, an essence that does not change. The structure and order exists in the universe amidst things that we see change with our physical senses. There's both change and non-change. There's both being and becoming. Being being non-change. The idea that I'm a human being, you're a human being, and it's something that can never change. Even though I may get shorter or taller or more gray hair or you name it, I do physically change, but the form or essence of who I am, I'm a being. I'm not just becoming. You remember Socrates drank the hemlock. He was a martyr for his philosophy because some of his students ended up among the 30 tyrants that governed Athens right after their defeat in the Peloponnesian War. They did not behave good. Society around them, once democracy was restored, blamed Socrates and said, either be exiled or drink the hemlock and die. And he chose to drink the hemlock and die for his philosophy. They accused him of corrupting the youth, in addition to being against their religion. Well, Socrates died there in 399 BC. Aristotle was born in 384 BC, 15 years later. 15 years after the death of Socrates, Aristotle was born. Plato, he was about 28 years old when Socrates died. And Plato died 347 BC. What we're going to see, and I'm going to cover a little bit with Aristotle's life, is that Aristotle, at the end of his life, is accused of the same thing that happened to Socrates, of corrupting the youth. And instead of dying for his philosophy, he chose exile. And I want to read a little bit as I introduce Aristotle and the power of philosophy of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle that were challenging sophist culture of that time, the relativistic, subjectivist culture of that time. R.C. Sproul, one of the books he wrote was The Consequences of Ideas. In his introduction, titled Why Philosophy, he wrote this. I'm going to read it, a couple pages. The summer of 1959. This date marked the end of my sophomore year in college and the tail end of the decade of happy days. The beloved Ike still in the office, the New York Yankees still dominated Major League Baseball, and the turbulent decade of the 60s was still a year away. My biggest concern was summer employment. Many friends who were engineering students had found lucrative summer jobs that paid well above the minimum wage. My prospects were bleak. I was a philosophy major. I did not find in the newspaper a single one ad calling for philosophers. My only real option was a job for unskilled labor paying the minimum wage. Even at that, I was delighted to be offered work in the maintenance department of a hospital. When the foreman heard I was a philosophy major, he handed me a broom and said, "Here, you can think all you want while you're leaning on the broom." My co-workers enjoyed this calumny. Among other responsibilities, I was to sweep the hospital's driveway and parking area. During my first week on the job, I was reaching the end of my sweeping territory. My zone ended where the main hospital driveway intersected the parking lot of the nurse's home. I noticed another man sweeping the adjacent parking lot. He greeted me, and we exchanged names and pleasantries. When I told him I was a college student, he asked what I was studying. When I said philosophy, his face brightened and his eyes lit up. He fired a barrage of questions at me, inquiring about Descartes, Plato, Hegel, Kant, Kierkegaard, and others. I was astonished at this man's knowledge. He obviously knew far more about philosophy than I did. I thought it bizarre that an adult whose chief occupation is to sweep driveways could be so erudite in the abstract field of philosophy. The whole conversation seemed incongruous to me. I had to ask him how he knew so much about philosophy. His story was heart-wrenching. My new friend was from Germany. He had his PhD in philosophy and had been a professor of philosophy in Berlin. When Adolf Hitler came to power, the Nazis were not content to find a final solution for Jews and Gypsies. They also sought to eliminate intellectuals whose ideas were at odds with the values of the Third Reich. My friend was removed from his position. When he spoke out against the Nazis, his wife and all but one of his children were arrested and executed, and he escaped from Germany with his young daughter. When I asked why he was no longer teaching, he said that teaching philosophy had destroyed the lives of his loved ones and ruined his own. With tears in his eyes, he said that he now lived only for his daughter. When I heard this man's story, I was 20 years old. To me, World War II was a dim memory. To a 20-year-old, 14 years seemed like an eternity. But to my German friend, who was in his mid-50s, the war years seemed like yesterday. The memory of the past was by no means dim. I mused on something else that morning, which is why I am recounting the tale here. I was pushing a broom because I lived in a culture that sees little value in philosophy and gives a scant esteem to those who pursue it. My friend was pushing a broom, on the other hand, because he came from a culture that gave great weight to philosophy. His family was destroyed because Hitler understood that ideas are dangerous. Hitler so feared the consequences of my friend's ideas that he did everything possible to eliminate him and his ideas. And to me, I couldn't help but think about Socrates and Aristotle reading that. Aristotle was born in 384 BC and died 322 BC. He was a student at Plato's Academy in Athens for 20 years, from age 18 to 38. For 20 years, Aristotle studied under Plato at Plato's Academy in Athens. John Frame notes that Aristotle was certainly Plato's equal in terms of brilliance, comprehensiveness, and influence on later thought. Someone has said that no pupil has ever had a greater teacher, and no teacher a greater student. Think about that with regard to Plato and Aristotle. That it could be said that no pupil has had a greater teacher, and no teacher a greater student. After Plato died in 347 BC, Aristotle traveled some northeast of the Aegean Sea near Troy, east of Greece, and around 342 BC, Aristotle was summoned to Macedonia by King Philip II and appointed the personal tutor of the king's son, Alexander, who at the time was just 13 years old. This made sense given Aristotle's family background. Aristotle's city of birth was Stagira, a Greek city subject to the half-barbarous, half-Hellenized Macedonian state in Southeast Europe, north of Greece. And Aristotle was the son of a physician to the king of Macedonia. So Aristotle is from a city. His city of birth is a Greek city that was within Macedonia. And he's the son of a physician who had been a physician to the king of Macedonia. So it made sense that the king of Philip, when he heard that Aristotle was in Troy, summoned him to be a tutor, a teacher to his 13-year-old Alexander. It is no stretch to say, as Russell Kirk does, that Aristotle had seen the world turned upside down in his own lifetime, for which Aristotle himself played a key role through his instruction of Alexander. Alexander's brilliance certainly can be seen as a military leader, and that's why Alexander is referred to as Alexander the Great. For at least 3 years, the famous philosopher Aristotle instructed in ethics and rhetoric the young Alexander, who was to conquer most of the known world. From Aristotle, Alexander the Great's military conquests were motivated in large measure by his desire to create a unified culture in the ancient world, a culture unified by a common language, Greek. And there's one thing that you do see from Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle is a passion for unity, structure and unity in this world of apparent chaos. And that's partly the motivation of Alexander in bringing the Greek culture and language to the known world at that time, even though by military force. And because of this program of Hellenization by Alexander through military force, it extended to Palestine, and therefore the New Testament was written in Greek rather than Hebrew or Latin. So we can say that indirectly, why we have the New Testament written in Greek, not Hebrew or Latin, is because of Aristotle's 3 years of teaching Alexander. When Alexander was 13 to 16 years old, Aristotle taught him ethics and rhetoric. The trajectory of Western civilization would indeed be shaped by Alexander the Great. Nick Needham, in his volumes in church history, said, quote, by the first century B.C., the Greek language, Greek methods of education, Greek art and literature, and Greek philosophy and science had taken root across the entire Roman Empire, all owing to military campaigns of Alexander the Great. In addition, Alexander the Great also received from Aristotle a passion for scientific knowledge. So he included in his vast array of soldiers a virtual army of scientists for the express purpose of collecting flora and fauna and of classifying and analyzing these specimens. And we're going to be looking at Aristotle's theory of categories. In fact, R.C. Sproul even notes that some have said that there's probably no scientific expedition that compares to what Alexander did with all of the scientists he brought with his military. You have to almost go to Nassau and everything that took place under Nassau trying to go to the moon. When Alexander became king of Macedonia, Aristotle, then 50 years old, returned to Athens and established a new school, the Lyceum, where he would teach and write until the death of Alexander, far away in Asia in the year 323 BC. The Athenian democracy at that time, roughly the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, they'd been under the thumb of Macedonia because of Alexander the Great's military conquest. Well, the Athenian democracy then rebelled against the Macedonian rule over them. They falsely accused Aristotle of impiety, as they had done with Socrates, but Aristotle refused to drink the poison hemlock, choosing exile instead, and he died a few months later at the age of 63 in 322 BC. That's just a short biography of Aristotle. Aristotle taught a wide variety of subjects, including logic, rhetoric, poetry, ethics, biology, physics, astronomy, political theory, economics, aesthetics, and anatomy, not to mention metaphysical philosophy. Really, when you look at Socrates, who taught Plato, who taught Aristotle, to me, Aristotle is the fruit of those two others, Socrates and Plato. We grow on the shoulders of those who have gone before us, and all three of them were fighting against the sophists, fighting against the relativism, the subjectivism, and the chaos of the sophists. But you really get to the apex of brilliance with Aristotle in all these subjects. Well, we're not going to look at all these subjects of what Aristotle had to say on all these things, but our interest here in our study involves Aristotle's beliefs that influenced America in Western civilization. And significantly, for Aristotle, as for Plato especially, there was no real dividing line between politics and ethics. In their philosophy, there was no real dividing line between politics and ethics. Rightly ordering the polis, the civil society, depends on rightly ordered individuals. A good and just republic depends on a moral citizenry, We stressed that the last time, especially with Plato. Well, it's the same with Aristotle. To have a good and just republic, it depends on a moral citizenry. To have a well-ordered republic depends on a well-ordered citizenry. So ethics, the order of the individual, cannot be discussed apart from politics, the order of civil society. In this arena of thought, however, Aristotle and Plato did have some important differences. Within his wide array of intellectual expertise, Aristotle is especially honored as a natural philosopher, what we would call a physical scientist. At his school that he set up, the Lyceum in Athens, there were trails through trees, and he would teach. He's a peripatetic teacher. He would walk and teach through the trails to his students. And you can imagine him, with his knowledge on all these subjects, finding lots of illustrations in nature to explain things, as we're going to see as well today. Science literally means knowledge. Aristotle believed that to gain knowledge requires the principles of logic, as well as general propositions such as the whole is greater than the part. Now, these first principles cannot be proved, really. They're known intuitively, according to Aristotle. And on these first principles, scientific knowledge can be arrived. One of the first principles, in fact, the chief principle of logic, is the law of non-contradiction. Something cannot be what it is and not be what it is at the same time and in the same sense or relationship. Something cannot be what it is and not be what it is at the same time and in the same sense or relationship. Another name for these first principles is presuppositions. The idea of having presuppositions are assumptions that cannot be proven by empirical science. But they're tools of knowledge. They're instruments of knowledge necessary in order to achieve knowledge. R.C. Sproul hammers it over and over again in different writings of his that Aristotle did not invent logic. He's typically falsely said to have been the one that invented it. He didn't invent it. He discovered it. He discerned it in reality. And acknowledging that is acknowledging that objective reality is orderly, is rational. Aristotle did not impose order on the universe. Rather, he discerned the order that's there. He referred to them as the organon or instrument of all science. The organon or instrument of all science. My specialty in my undergrad degree, Bachelor of Science in Forest Resources at the University of Minnesota, my specialty was silviculture, which is applied forest biology, biological sciences. Love studying biology. But you have your kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, all of the various categories. Why? Because something cannot be what it is and not what it is, either at the same time and in the same relationship. You end up with categories. Something is similar to something else, but different than something else. Everything is categorized according to logic. So the reality, the real world, is logical. It's rational. As R.C. Sproul states, logic is essential to intelligible discourse. We've talked about this. That which is not logical, that which is illogical, is unintelligible. It is not only not understood, but it is incapable of being understood. We've stressed that only that which is rational and logical can be understood with the human mind. Logic is a tool for thinking rationally, determining whether one's statements are valid or invalid, But logic itself does not determine the truth of a conclusion or an argument. It just tells you the relationship of statements. R.C. Sproul states, statements may either be true or false, but the logical relationship of one statement to another is either valid or invalid. In other words, not everything that is rational is real, but everything that is real is rational. I can describe for you rationally what a unicorn looks like. That doesn't mean it's real. We do know, though, if anything is real, it is rational. And this is Aristotle's argument. For Aristotle, the laws of logic apply to all sciences because they are valid for all reality. For Aristotle, the laws of logic apply to all sciences because they are valid for all reality. And this is a man who had an expertise in a wide array of subjects about reality. If all reality is logical, then there is a rational order and structure to all reality, which means things exist in real, rational categories. As Christians, we believe God created each after their kind in Genesis 1. Rejecting the sophists, Aristotle agreed with Socrates and Plato that universal words correspond to reality. Goodness, truth, beauty, justice, man. I can point to a man, but man. Universal sense that would encompass every one of us here. That universal word, according to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, corresponds to reality. For Aristotle, universal words correspond to reality, describing similarities and differences of individual things in distinct categories. Remember, this is very important because among the pagan mythical gods and goddesses of the mythology of ancient Greece, all it is a chaotic stream of organic matter in ancient Greek mythology. Just a chaotic stream of organic matter. No structure, no order, no real categories that exist. According to the sophists, it's the same thing according to the sophists. That's why there's, in our day, the same thing. Transgenderism. Everything is fluid. Everything, there's really no categories. Everything's fluid. Remember this, for the sophists, universal words do not correspond to reality. So this idea of categories is extremely important to refute the sophists. Extremely important for us today to think, how do we speak to many of the neo-pagan radicals from the 1960s and their children and grandchildren? How do we speak to them? R.C. Sproul summarizes Aristotle's concept of categories. A word that means everything actually means nothing. I'll let you savor that one. A word that means everything actually means nothing. We've got to proceed with very clear definitions, right? R.C. Sproul continues, summarizing Aristotle's concept of categories. To be meaningful, a word must both affirm something and deny something. For Aristotle, the categories refer to ideas that can be predicated of a particular substance. The categories refer to ideas that can be predicated, asserted about a particular substance. Now, for Aristotle, these categories include the following: quantity, quality, relations, place, date, posture, possession, action, and passivity. Those are things that can be predicated of a particular substance. Quantity, quality, relations, place, date, posture, possession, action, and passivity. For Aristotle, these categories function as predicates, what can be affirmed or denied about things. What can be affirmed or denied about things. To be very detailed about what you're asserting positively or negatively about something. Putting it into a category. Well, what is this something? He says it's of a particular substance. This is very important. For Aristotle, the substance is the essential reality or form or being of a thing. The essential reality or form or being of a thing. I'm a human being. You're a human being. Remember, with being and becoming, being does not change. Becoming is dealing with change, growth, development, change, motion, becoming. Being is form. It's the essence of something that does not change. And for Aristotle, he says the substance, it's a very particular term for him, the substance is the essential reality or form or being of a thing. The essence of a thing, in other words. So those categories are predicates of a substance, of the essence of something, and how you're either affirming or denying something, of the essence of something, the form of something, the being of something. And its accidens, this is another term he used, accidens, A-C-C-I-D-E-N-S, its accidens are its predicates or categories. So everything has both substance and accidens. Has both its substance, its form or essence or being, as well as its accidens, the things that can be predicated in these categories about it. The accidens relate to our physical senses, okay, of what we're observing, tasting, feeling, etc., with things. Aristotle said we can distinguish between the substance and the accidents of an individual thing, but we can never separate them. In other words, Aristotle maintained that a thing's accidents are generated by or flow out of its substance. So from its substance, from its form or being or essence, flows certain predicates, certain accidents, certain categories. An example is bread. Take bread. Bread, for example, has a specific taste and texture. That's the accidens. What can you can assert about it? What texture does it have? What taste does it have? You can begin to categorize it. The accidens that you're sensing with your physical senses. So bread has a specific texture and taste. That's its accidens because of its breadness. It flows out of its breadness. It has a certain essence or being or form of breadness. And then that then produces certain accidens, certain predicates, things that we can affirm or deny about it in these categories. Okay? Now, all of this is important. You're saying, why am I bothering with all this metaphysics? All this metaphysics is important because out of this flows ethics and politics. Okay? And that was the same for Plato, as we saw last time we met with Plato. In fact, it's the same for Christianity. I'll say more about that at the end. For Aristotle, all reality exists in one world, not two. All reality exists in one world, not two. For Aristotle, man's soul is the form of the body. You remember, for Plato, the human soul was independent of the human body, but presently confined in it with recollections, remembrances of the spiritual world from which the soul came. How is it that we bring together and unify and make sense of all of the change and becoming we see and observe, and yet there's structure and order. Categories. How do we unify and make sense of both of them, of Parmenides and Heraclitus? Remember, Plato said, well, I think this is where there's the spiritual realm, the spiritual world that has pure ideas, pure forms, pure beings of all these things. Human souls are eternal and have seen that world, experienced it. They become imprisoned in a body, but have recollections and remembrances of that world, and that's how we remember. We're in this realm of the shadows in the cave, the imperfect copies. That's what our world, that with our physical senses, experience, according to Plato, is the imperfect copies, a world of imperfect copies of that spiritual world of pure ideas and pure forms. We live in the shadows, but with the remembrances of that world through our soul, that's independent of our body, but presently confined in it. So he had a view, like Socrates, of the immortality of the soul. Aristotle does not. It tends to be that it's kind of tied up with the body for Aristotle. Aristotle said that all substance is a combination of form and matter. All substance is a combination of form and matter. So substance is the essential reality or form or essence or being of something. And it's a combination of form and matter. For Plato, it's another world where the forms are. And this world is the imperfect copies of physical matter that's changing all the time. That's where Plato, remember, said the spiritual world with pure forms and pure ideas that never change, that is more real than the physical world. So he had some part of reality more real than other parts of reality. Living in the shadows and cave of the imperfect copies that we do in the physical material world that's changing and becoming all the time is less real than the spiritual world, according to Plato. Aristotle's saying there's only one world, and the forms are always with the matter. And that's the substance. All substance, meaning I have substance. There's the real essence or form of man. And same with you, that it's a part of who we are. Form and matter are always together. I'm a human being, and that being, that form, is not in another realm, as Plato would say. It's in me, is what Aristotle would say. It's in you. You're a human being, and that form is in you, of humanness. And the form is in me of humanness. That form and matter are combined together. That we never encounter form without matter, or matter without form, according to Aristotle. That's different than Plato. For Aristotle, forms or ideas have no independent existence apart from matter. Now, he studied 20 years from age 18 to 38 under Plato. You know, he's disagreeing with Plato, but saying this is how he's bringing together, though, Parmenides and Heraclitus in each thing. That this is the substance, and it includes form that does not change, being, and it includes becoming, matter. Both in its substance. Not two worlds, not two realms. For Aristotle, there is no ideal realm where forms or ideas exist in and of themselves. For Aristotle, a human soul and body are inseparable, and essentially the soul vanishes when the body dies, for Aristotle. But the form of catness really exists in each individual cat, for example. Just like breadness really exists in each bread, and manness really exists in each man. The form of manness is in each man. The form of catness is in each cat. The form of breadness is in each bread. The unchanging being or form of each individual thing really exists within each individual thing, which Aristotle called entelechy. E-N-T-E-L-E-C-H-Y. It gave it a term. Scientists always like to give terms, and philosophers give terms to things. That's what Aristotle called it. The unchanging being or form of each individual thing really exists within each thing, and that's the entelechy. Determining what each individual thing develops into. In Aristotle's mind, form and matter are always together, and the form within us, the entelechy, determines what you will develop into, because we are both being and becoming. So what will you develop into? What will you grow into? An Aristotle example is acorns. Acorns do not grow into elephants because they contain the entelechy, the form or essence or being of oak tree-ness, not elephant-ness. Now, let me pause. We use this argument as pro-lifers against abortionists. From conception on, when the father's sperm and the mother's egg meet and it's fertilized, and it becomes an embryo and a fetus and then a newborn infant and a child and an adolescent. What is it? The whole point, all the way through, its form or essence is determining what it will grow into. That embryo is not going to become an elephant. The embryo is not going to become a cat. Or that fetus is not going to become a dog. The form or essence is there in the thing, determining what it will become and grow into. On the same logic. That's what we tell people. But we know the genetic code is there as a mixture of the genes from the mother and the father. The entelechy, determining what we will grow into. Now, Aristotle, he didn't have information of DNA, the genetic code back then. In addition, we observe that each individual thing changes, so each individual thing is also becoming. It not only has its form or being or essence in its substance, but also becoming, because all substance is a combination of form and matter, being and becoming. For Aristotle, all change represents a kind of motion. So if anything is changing, it is a kind of motion. And since there is motion, there must be a cause for motion. And Aristotle delineated four distinct types of causes. We in our age tend to look at it causation singularly. Just say, what's the cause of something? But Aristotle delineated four distinct causes. So if there's becoming, if there's change, it is a form of motion. It's a kind of motion. Well, when you're dealing with motion, then something must have caused the motion. So this is where he delineated four types of causes. The formal cause, material cause, efficient cause, and final cause. The entelechy within each thing is the formal cause. That form or being or essence in the thing, in the substance, is the formal cause. It's the blueprint of what it will become. The material cause is the physical stuff out of which it is made. That's what many of the pre-Socratic philosophers were concerned with, the arche. What was the ultimate stuff of which things are made? This is Aristotle saying That's the material cause. When you're thinking along those lines, what's the material cause? The physical stuff out of which things are made. The efficient cause is the tool or instrument by which something is made. And the final cause is the purpose for which something is made. The purpose for which something is made. This is very important. He's bringing purpose and design into this whole thing, into all of reality. For Aristotle, being, which involves no change, and becoming, which involves change, are understood within the idea of motion in terms of actuality and potentiality. So if there's change, it's a kind of motion, which then there must be some cause of motion. Well, there's different causes. Within each substance, form and matter are combined. Within each thing, within each substance, form and matter are combined. The form is the being of something, the essence of something. The matter is the becoming, the change. Being and becoming, form and matter combined in the substance, he would look at it as actuality and potentiality. That the form and matter are combined within each substance, within each thing. And he would describe it, Aristotle describes it as actuality and potentiality. R.C. Sproul illustrates Aristotle's thinking. He says this, an oak tree begins with an acorn. The acorn is not actually an oak tree, but it has the potentiality of becoming one. The potential is realized when it actually becomes an oak tree. But nothing contains any potentiality unless it first has actuality. So within the acorn, you have both form and matter, being and becoming. So there's motion, there's going to be growth, there's going to be change. It's going to develop into something. The acorn is going to develop into an oak tree, right? And the form of it determines what it will develop into, so it has the form of tree oakness. But he describes that motion and development then of being and becoming of form and matter with actuality and potentiality. The acorn has the potential to become an oak tree. But that potential, when it's realized, is when it actually becomes an oak tree. But nothing contains any potentiality unless it first has actuality. Since actuality is primary for Aristotle, there must be something that is pure or absolute actuality. Potentiality by itself is nothing. Potentiality by itself is nothing. Actuality is primary. It has to actually be a chicken first. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have the form of chickenness. Actuality comes first, yes. And since actuality then is primary, there must be something that is pure or absolute actuality. There must be something that exists in perfect form. This is where the logic flows then. There must be something that is pure or absolute actuality. Pure or absolute actuality means it exists in its perfect form with no unrealized potential. Now, this is Aristotle's God, small g. Okay? Now, you think in the Christian worldview, I say, who is God? God is pure being. No change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Who is God? He's perfect in every way. No unrealized potentiality. That's who God is. He's perfect in every way. The thinking here of Aristotle, the pagan, is amazing. One of my professors in graduate school and taught political philosophy says it's Aristotle who became the closest to Christianity. Pure or absolute actuality means it exists in perfect form with no unrealized potential. It has no change or motion or development or growth of any kind since it exists in perfect form. From which Aristotle then developed the idea of the unmoved mover. Has to be the ultimate explanation of all of this is an unmoved mover that exists in pure actuality. Aristotle said the unmoved mover is the ultimate cause of motion. Aristotle understood you don't want to fall into this infinite regression of what caused this and caused that and caused that and caused that, and you never get to a start. An infinite regression of causes. Aristotle said the unmoved mover is the ultimate cause of motion, who itself is not caused. That every effect has a cause, but the unmoved mover is not an effect. Aristotle said the unmoved mover is the ultimate cause of motion and must be rooted in pure being or pure actuality. It must be eternal, immaterial, and immutable. Eternal, immaterial, not material, and immutable, not changing. No growth, no development, no unrealized potentiality, pure being, perfection. For Aristotle, the unmoved mover was not personal, though. This is where he differs from Christianity, right? We believe God exists in pure being, and he is spirit. John 4:24. He does not change. Hebrews 13:8. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Why? There's no unrealized potentiality. God is perfect, unchanging, pure being. Perfect in every way, the unmoved mover, not an effect, but is the ultimate cause of all things. But for Aristotle, the unmoved mover was not personal, or the living and true God is personal. For Aristotle, the unmoved mover was a kind of impersonal force that is the ultimate form of eternal matter. So in addition to being the formal cause of all things, it exists in pure form, and it's the formal cause of all things. Aristotle said the unmoved mover is the efficient cause of all things. He said moving the world by attraction. And it is the final cause of all things, directing all things to their proper end, their ultimate teleological purpose. It's very important. The unmoved mover is the final cause of all things, directing all things to their proper end or purpose. For Aristotle, since the unmoved mover is not personal, for Aristotle, it's ultimate thought that does not contemplate the world and offers no intelligent providence. It is pure thought, thinking of itself in perfection. But this is how Aristotle says then everything has purpose, flowing ultimately from the unmoved mover. Close to the real living and true God, but an idol. You and I know we all have purpose, created for God's glory, Isaiah 43:7. We have an end. Westminster Shorter Catechism, question number one, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. But it's similar to the recent table talk a couple months ago that said the chief end of all things, not just human beings, God, the unmoved mover, who's personal, sets the end of all things, his glory. The heavens declare the glory of God, and their expanse the work of his hands. Psalm 19:1 and following. Yeah, we do not know that Aristotle had any influence from the Pentateuch or the Old Testament. This is why, as we'll say toward the end, why Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, who died 1274 A.D., utilized a lot of Aristotle's way of explaining things to explain Christianity in his Summa Theologia, the systematic theology. Theology is the queen of the sciences. The Bible is the queen of the sciences, and philosophy or handmaiden. To utilize some of the way Aristotle explains things to help explain Christian truths. R.C. Sproul was very good at that as well. And I'll just say as a side note, with accidents and substance, this is where the Roman Catholic Church uses Aristotle's way of explaining things to say that a miracle takes place in communion where the accidents remain the same and texture and taste of the bread and the juice remain the same, but the transubstantiation, the substance has been transferred into the actual body and blood of Christ, even though the accidents still remain, the predicates still remain of breadness and juiceness. The miracle is the transfer of the substance. Where Aristotle would say the accidents are always flowing out of the substance of anything. But this is where they themselves utilize Aristotle's way of explaining things to explain their heresy. Where as Protestants we believe in communion the substance and the accidents remain bread and juice. They are signs and symbols that point to the actual body and blood of Christ. But what's so fascinating is how Aristotle brings purpose then into everything, where the ultimate pure actuality and form, the unmoved mover, is the final cause of all things, directing all things to their proper ends. By the form each is given. And this will bring us into ethics, okay? Since every individual thing has both form and matter, Aristotle then put an element of purposeness or teleology into everything. So form then is not just what things are, the form or being or essence of something. It is also what they should be or strive to be. Form, then, is a normative category as well as a descriptive category. So if I am a human being, I have the form of humanness, then I ought to be human. And for me to behave as a dog or a cat is unethical. God created man in his image, male and female. If I am a male man, that is my form and essence, and I ought to be and behave as a man and not a woman, ethically. And a woman ought to behave as a woman, ethically. The form or essence is not just descriptive, but normative. Meaning ethical, what ought to be. So form is not just what things are, it is also what they should be, what they should strive to be. For Aristotle, as for Plato, true knowledge is a knowledge of form, not matter. When I really know something, it's to know its essence, its being, its form. Just to know that you have certain color hair, your certain weight, certain height, live at a certain location, all those predicates, the categories, the accidents, That's not real knowledge. Real knowledge is of the form, of the essence of something, the being of something. True knowledge is an understanding of what things are. By knowing what things are in their form or their essence, one then knows what ought to be. And since the form of man is normative, what man ought to be, a key question then is, what is the form of man? What is the form of man? For starters, Aristotle said human beings are rational animals. So for him, as well as with the other Greek philosophers, the good life is the life of reason, the life of thinking. All the philosophers of ancient Greece were committed to reason. Even contradictory, the sophists, contradicting themselves, were committed to reason. They defended their irrationality through reason. All of the philosophers were committed to reason. John Frame points that out repeatedly in his writings. The good life is the life of reason. Who are we? We're a rational animal. What sets us apart from dogs, cats, and other creatures? We have reason. We're able to think logically. For Aristotle, reason tells us that the goal of the human life is happiness. Happiness, though, is not pleasure. Don't think of it as just, oh, this is pleasurable and not painful. It's not in the narrow sense of the Epicureans, of that pure physical hedonism, just seeking physical pleasure and avoiding physical pain. No. Reason tells us that the goal of the human life is happiness. Happiness, though, for Aristotle, is general well-being. General well-being. Pleasure is at most a means to the end of happiness. It's not an end in itself. Aristotle also said that man is by nature a social being, not just a rational being. And human reason says we ought to seek happiness, and that's the good life. General well-being is what we seek, happiness. But Aristotle said as well that by nature we're a social being, that the form of man is social. What is the form or essence or being of man? Rational and social. We're not meant to just live in Timbuktu all by ourselves in isolation. As Christians, we would agree God created us with a human mind to understand Him, to communicate rationally with God, and to understand the rational world God created. But we're social creatures, meant to have a relationship with God and with one another. It's the essence of family. It's a part of the form of man, the essence of man. Aristotle, agreeing with his teacher Plato, Aristotle believed a good republic depends on good citizens. Once you begin to say man is social, and we're by nature social, that's the form of man is social, then that connects us with the polis. Having a civil society. Being political then. Being social. And Aristotle believed with Plato that a good republic depends on good citizens. For Aristotle, as for Plato, there existed no real dividing line between politics and ethics, as we've said. To study one is to study the other. Aristotle said this, quote, "A man in solitude must either be a beast or a god." In other words, not fully human. A man does not become fully human living all by himself in isolation. That's what Aristotle meant. Now you think about that. To say that the form of man is social means you do not develop into a full human being unless you're in social relationships. This is how Russell Kirk summarizes Aristotle on this point. It is in community that human beings realize their aim in existence. They become fully human only by becoming civilized. And civilization means the life of the city. Man is made for action, and the highest form of action is thought, rational and social. In the savage state, man thinks scarcely at all. Food and self-preservation. Unless we are social beings, we are not really human beings. So, where is the highest good for man? Where is man's happiness and general well-being found? For Aristotle, it is found in the polis, being a part of the polis, political society of the Greek city-state. Since man is by nature a social being and rational, to debate and discuss how to govern themselves. So, for Aristotle, ethics and politics are studied together. Ethics studies the state of man's mind or his character. Politics studies the polis as the means for attaining the highest human good. The means for attaining the highest human good is through the polis. As with Plato, human society in the polis is individual man writ large. Aristotle's understanding of order in society in the polis is boiled down to the same principle of order in each individual human being. In other words, Aristotle is saying the same principle that must govern each individual being, human being, in their order of their own individual lives, that same principle of order must also govern their social relationship in the polis. What is that? Nothing in excess. Nothing in excess is the principle of order for each individual human being as well as the polis. For maintaining order. Nothing in excess. It is expressed through Aristotle's doctrine of the mean, sometimes referred to as the golden mean. The golden mean. And it is here that fine distinctions are important. Listen to how Russell Crook summarizes Aristotle's doctrine of the mean, or the golden mean. This mean does not signify the average. If you've taken statistics, you know what I'm saying. What's the mean of this data set? Well, what's the average number of the total numbers that are there, right? The mean for Aristotle here, the golden mean, does not signify the average, the mediocre, or the splitting of the difference, which Aristotle called the disputed middle. Nor does the mean always signify necessarily the best. It does not signify the average. It does not necessarily always signify the best. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Rather, the mean amounts to that harmony achieved by avoiding excesses and extremes. It is moderation or balance in private life and in public. Moderation and balance. Harmony in one's private life and in public. That's the golden mean. It's not an average, and it's not always necessarily the best. Each individual human being seeking the highest good in ethics must be neither ascetic, somebody who's ascetic saying, I'm avoiding everything. I'm just living in sackcloth and ashes in a dirt hut. To seek the highest good in ethics, you must neither be ascetic nor gluttonous, but temperate. Temperate. Be neither cowardly nor rash, but prudently courageous. Be neither subservient nor arrogant. Be self-respecting. Now you think of these. You think cowardly or rash. This is practical wisdom that Aristotle's thinking through life and all these decisions that we make. You know, we have the old proverb, look before you leap, but you could become a coward. He who hesitates is lost. Jump! But this is the idea of don't be rash, but don't be a coward. Be prudently courageous. This is trying to find the golden mean in life. For Aristotle, he made a distinction between moral virtues and intellectual virtues. Moral virtues pertain to the will, and we learn the moral virtues, like courage, temperance, justice, from imitating those who exemplify these qualities. Through imitation is how we learn them. Such imitation leads us in time to form good habits, and those habits form a good character. As Paul said, imitate me as I imitate Christ, 1 Corinthians 11:1. We learn moral virtues of prudently courageous, temperance, and justice from imitating those who exemplify these qualities, and such imitation leads in time to forming good habits, and those habits form a good character. For Aristotle, the intellectual virtue is prudence, and that comes from teaching, according to Aristotle. Aristotle distinguishes philosophical wisdom, where you're disinterested, just contemplative, sitting and thinking hard about things, philosophical wisdom from practical wisdom, which is wisdom to make decisions leading to happiness. Practical wisdom is wisdom that leads decisions for happiness. One with practical wisdom, according to Aristotle, will seek the golden mean. Nothing in excess. There are different ways we can respond to things all the time. Again, for Aristotle, human society is individual man writ large, just like Plato. As it is with the individual, so it is with the state, with the polis, in the practical science of politics. If every individual is to seek the golden mean, nothing in excess, it ought to be the same in man's social relationships and politics. Both must seek the golden mean for the highest good. Typically, in politics, we should accept the mean of government, the golden mean, which is not the best conceivable state in that it is not perfect, but still it is the most satisfactorily conditional arrangement for peace that a community is likely to realize. We as Christians would say we live in a sin-cursed world. It's fallen. Among human societies and polises, you're not going to find the perfect one here. And that's like Abraham Kuyper, great Dutch theologian, prime minister of the Netherlands, 1901 to 1905, says, do not, many Christians make this mistake, do not judge your civil government by the perfect. It's not to be found here. You have to think in your mind, you judge it by what would be without it, the pre-noadic condition where violence filled the earth. There's much to be thankful for through God's common grace of having a civil government, even though it's not perfect. But some are better than others. The ones that seek the golden mean in this fallen, sin-cursed world are the best, according to Aristotle. In politics, then, we should seek the mean of government, which is the golden mean. It's not the best conceivable state. It's not perfect. But still, it's the most satisfactory condition of peace that a community is likely to realize. Aristotle is a practical realist, understanding that in the present condition of humanity that he observes, a perfect political condition is not attainable. As Christians, we agree. So then, what is the political mean of government? What's the golden mean for government? Well, to answer that question, one must understand what various forms of government are possible. What forms of government are possible? Aristotle studied the Democratic Republic of Athens, which we've looked at extensively in detail already, through Solon's reforms in the 6th century BC and onward. Aristotle studied the Democratic Republic of Athens as well as other republics of his day and other republics, including the long-lasting Republic of Sparta, the oligarchic Republic of Sparta. And I said I would cover a little bit of Sparta's republic. I didn't write it on the board, so just listen carefully. I'm going to lay out for you Sparta's republic. They had an oligarchic republic. And as you know, they were the military leaders of ancient Greece, military society. Sparta's republic had an elaborate distribution of powers to prevent tyranny, always centered in an oligarchy rather than a democracy. They did not like democracy. So again, republics are mixed forms of government with monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. They're a mixture. It's just which one dominates of that mixture. In Athens, the democratic part of it dominated. In Sparta, the oligarchic part dominates to a certain extent. Well, Sparta, I believe I've mentioned it already in this course, but Sparta made the Messenia farmers to the west. They made them helots. They made them sharecroppers for them. So in a sense, they were the slaves for Sparta. They militarily dominated this region just over the mountain pass to their west. They were on the Peloponnese Peninsula, southwest Greece. This is where Sparta was, an inland area in a valley. But over the mountain pass were these Messenia farmers. And Sparta defeated them militarily and made them sharecroppers so that Sparta would get quite a bit of their food. Not all the food, but quite a bit of the food from these helots. And the helots got to keep a little bit for themselves. And then Sparta could just maintain a military regime where all the men did not do any farming, grew their hair long, which showed they were not farmers, but warriors. Sparta had two hereditary military generals as executives, functioning as priestly kings. Two hereditary military generals as two chief executives functioning as priestly kings. They would appoint ambassadors and envoys, and they were involved in about everything in Sparta. These two executives that were two hereditary military generals. These two kings or executives sat with a council of 28 elders or aristocrats of the wealthy class of Sparta. So altogether there was 30 in that group, all over the age of 60. It was called the Gerousia, G-E-R-O-U-S-I-A, of the 28 elders and aristocrats with the two hereditary military generals acting as priestly kings. Sparta also had an assembly which included all Spartan citizens, which were about 8,000, all the men who were also the soldiers. And they elected the 28 elders to sit on that Gerousia council with the two hereditary military kings. So those 28 elders, aristocrats, were elected from the assembly, all 60 years of age or older. The Spartan assembly met monthly, all 8,000 of them, all citizens, and they were required to pass all laws and any decree on war or peace. Now they were the soldiers. Were the citizens? All the soldiers, all the men. And they're the ones that passed all laws and any decree on war or peace. The 30-member Gerousia Council set the agenda for the assembly and guarded the laws of Sparta if the assembly got out of hand. Kind of a check on the assembly. There were also 5 executives in another group, 5 executives called ephors, E-P-H-O-R-S, elected annually by random lot from the assembly of citizens for 1-year terms. 5 executives called ephors, elected annually by random lot from the assembly of citizens for 1-year terms with near tyrannical judicial powers to oversee the other Spartan magistrates, especially the 2 hereditary military generals. So those 5 from the assembly, chosen by random lot, served 1-year terms but had judicial supremacy. Moreover, there was a public monthly oath between the 2 kings and the 5 ephors, where the 2 kings vowed to obey the laws of Sparta publicly, and the ephors vowed to support the kings if they do in fact obey the laws. And there was a period of time, I had read, where the ephors removed quite a few kings of these hereditary generals. But everything was meant to stabilize and balance the various interests of the Spartan polis. Change was meant to occur slowly. And that was at America's founding as well. The founders of America set up our republic so that change would take place slowly. That you'd have it well thought out. Not rash, but the golden mean. Prudently courageous. Think about it here. Let me share somehow this connectedness of balance and stability in their republic in Sparta. Having a random lot elect the 5 ephors from the assembly prevented the 2 kings from controlling that selection. It's by random lot. So they can't use money and power to influence who gets that position to check them. The ephors who served 1-year terms were audited by their successors, whose selection they could not control since it was by random lot. Saying, you're going to be audited next year by the next ephors. So you better do a good job or you're going to get in trouble. The ephors were chosen from the entire assembly of citizens, which preserved a sense of representative popular government. By random lot, any one of the citizens could become an ephor. Finally, the 2 kings tended to be rivals of each other and counterbalanced one another on their decisions, typically. So in a sense, similar to the checks and balances in Solon's political and legal reforms in 6th century Athens, Sparta's mixed form of government tended to support a golden mean for them. But you can think, Aristotle studying Sparta, studying Athens, studying all of these different republics, in his day and before. And Aristotle assessed that there were 3 forms of right government. 3 forms of right government formed among men for their good. Monarchy, aristocracy, and what he called commonwealth. Commonwealth. Now, this is the way Russell Kirk summarizes Aristotle on these 3 right forms of government. All I put on the board were the 3 forms, but listen carefully to this. This is very important. By monarchy, Aristotle signifies the leadership of one man of excellent virtue under a body of laws which limit his power. That's what he meant by monarchy, as a right form of government. The leadership of one man of excellent virtue under a body of laws which limit his power. And isn't that what we saw was supposed to be the monarchy in ancient Israel? Where the king was to write out the Torah of Deuteronomy by hand, and now he's under the law like everyone else, God's law? By aristocracy, as a right form of government, Aristotle signifies the predominance of a class of men of high birth, dutiful and filled with the spirit which would later be called the noblesse oblige, the noble spirit of caring for all. Even though they're wealthy and of high birth, they care for all. It's the right form of government where the aristocrats rule, but they rule on behalf of all, what's good for all. By a commonwealth, what Aristotle signifies is the exercise of power by a majority, but a virtuous majority, respecting the lawful rights of all classes. That's what he meant by commonwealth. Now, in America, we have the Commonwealth of Virginia. That's still what they go by right now. We sit here, right? We would say the state of Virginia, but it's the Commonwealth of Virginia, technically. Aristotle said, I'm studying everything that is existing in my day and prior, and this is what I discern are three forms of right government. But when it's a monarch, it must be a virtuous monarch when it's right, and under a body of laws that restrict his power. And when it's an aristocracy, it's where the few who are wealthy, of high birth, but they rule out of that noble spirit for the good of all. That's when it's right, but it can be done. And then when it's the majority are ruling, it's a commonwealth, when they're respecting all classes of people, not just doing what's in best interest of the majority only and forget about the minority. So evil governments, then, are deviations of these three forms of right government. Democracy is the evil form of commonwealth. It's the rule by the crowd for the benefit of the dominant majority. Oligarchy is the evil form of aristocracy. Oligarchy is rule by a few for the good of that few. Tyranny is the evil form of monarchy. Tyranny is unconstitutional assumption of power by one man for his own satisfaction. But notice, in each evil government, the exercise of power is done for a select group rather than the general welfare of the entire polis. So in each right one, it's for the general welfare of all, whether monarchy, aristocracy, or commonwealth. So in short, right government demands that one govern for the general welfare of all who are in society. So as with individual human beings, the rulers of the polis ought to seek the happiness or general welfare of its citizens. That's a right government. So then, what is the best form of government? What's the best form of government? And this is where Aristotle advocates a mixed government, a government of the golden mean. A mixed government means a republic. A republic. The ingredients of the mixture varying with particular circumstances to incorporate the virtues of the several forms. To incorporate the virtues of the several forms. So it's a republic is a mixed government. It's a mixture of monarchy, aristocracy, and commonwealth in his terms, in order to bring forth the virtues of what's best out of each type. That's what the American founders did. The U.S. president is meant to be the best of monarchy. You say he acts like a king. Well, he ought to, in our constitutional system, under the laws of the United States Constitution. But of the virtues of a monarch, yes. And the U.S. Senate is to be the best of aristocracy, with the noble meaning and intent. And the U.S. House is to be the best of the Commonwealth, then, in Aristotle's terms, best of democracy. But the ingredients and mixture varying with particular circumstances. He has that practical wisdom in the golden mean of saying, where is their balance and harmony for this people group? Different people groups, some have more poor people, some have more artisans and sailors, some have more farmers, some have more soldiers, Sparta. You see, different people groups have different circumstances. So practical wisdom say you've got to consider the circumstances for the best mixed government. practical wisdom, then, studying the Democratic Republic of Athens after Solon's reforms, as well as Sparta and the other Greek city-states, the polity that promotes the highest good for man, according to Aristotle, is ordinarily a mixture of aristocracy and commonwealth, or of oligarchy and democracy. It's kind of interesting to say that. Ordinarily, it's a mixture of aristocracy and commonwealth, or of oligarchy and democracy. Of the few and the majority, in both. Not always with kings and monarchs. But then you say, why? Well, this mixture of government is the mean because it tends to be dominated by the middle class, is what Aristotle would say. A republic, a mixed government, especially when it's mixed between aristocracy and commonwealth, it's dominated by the middle class. In his day, the middle class were farmers, property owners, who managed their own farms. Independent, self-governing people making all sorts of decisions on the family farm with property they manage and take care of. Aristotle looked at the middle class farmers of his day. He said they're neither rich nor poor. Neither are they the mob of artisans and sailors without property. The middle class farmers of Aristotle's day were the most productive economically, less rash than the other classes of people, and more stable in their family life. He wants happiness for people. Happiness in the polis, happiness for individuals, right? The happiness of the polis depends on the happiness of individuals, a moral citizenry, who are following the golden mean, nothing in excess. I'll just say, as a side note, Victor Davis Hanson wrote an entire book that's pretty thick just on the farmers, the middle-class farmers of ancient Greece. Following the golden mean in a mixed government, domination either by the selfish rich or the envious poor would be avoided. Aristocratic violence and popular roguery would be avoided. You're trying to avoid the extremes. In a mixed government, as much as possible, society will have a community of friendship, is what Aristotle said. Community of friendship founded upon common affections as well as upon common interests. As we have said, citizens are those committed to the common good. Such community of friendship with a common understanding of what is good is hard to achieve in a fallen, sin-cursed world in which we live. Aristotle confessed that true politics rarely are encountered. Remember, Aristotle lived at the time when ancient Greece was in decadent decline. He lived after the Golden Age of Athens, after the Peloponnesian War. He lived in the 300s. The history of Greece, as Russell Kirk notes, is a cautionary tale of class conflict, disunity, internecine violence, private and public arrogance and selfishness, imperial vainglory, and civic collapse. Not a pretty picture. Significantly, even Aristotle's student Alexander the Great's military effort to force Greek culture on the known world at that time resulted in the ruin of Greek ethics and the Greek politics that Aristotle praised and expounded. Tried to force it, but it collapsed everything. Russell Kirk states, "What followed upon the death of Alexander and the death of Aristotle was the death of the polis in ancient Greece." In Russell Kirk's opinion, the failure of the Greeks to find an enduring popular religious sanction for the order of their civilization had been the main cause of the collapse of the world of the polis in ancient Greece. I'll read that again. The failure of the Greeks to find an enduring popular religious sanction for the order of their civilization had been the main cause of the collapse of the world of the polis in ancient Greece. By contrast, Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman, observed America in 1831 AD, and he observed that America was held together by a religious bond stronger than the Greeks or the Romans had known, by a Christian faith that worked upon individual and family rather than through a state cult. A well-structured republic, a mixed government, following the golden mean of Aristotle, only goes so far. For continued success, the polis depends upon a moral people to succeed. And Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle all asserted that, as well as America's founders. The mythical gods and goddesses of ancient Greece did not provide it, but neither did the ethical philosophies of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Even though these philosophers defended the idea of objective morality, order and structure in the universe, against the relativism and subjectivism of the sophists. Overall, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, they all lacked specificity and detail in their ethics, in their moral standards. For Plato, it was the good. Aristotle, the golden mean. But you lack specificity and detail. Human reason can only go so far. We show the work of the law written in our hearts, certainly as they evidenced. And as many of the early church fathers said, they prepared the way for Christianity as they rebutted and rebuked the sophists. As we've seen, Aristotle has many ways of thinking that coincide with Christian ways of thinking. Thomas Aquinas died 1274 AD, utilized much of Aristotle's way of describing things to explain Christianity. God's law, though, revealed to Moses as recorded in the Bible, provides us the details and the specificity we need for individuals, families, marriages, businesses, and civil government, neighborly relations. God's law, revealed to Moses as recorded in the Bible, provides us the details and the specificity we need as we studied in detail as we traveled through Jerusalem. Now this ends our journey through Athens. And our next stop, Lord willing, as we ponder America and Western civilization, we'll be traveling through the city of Rome. So we've traveled through Jerusalem, and now Athens. Lord willing, we'll travel through Rome and then through London to America. So Lord willing, next time we meet, we'll pick up with the story of Rome.